we became friends, and we did things together, went shopping together, and she took me to stores in Nuremberg that did not usually cater to Americans, etc. And one day, we were shopping, and she said, let's do a very German thing and go have coffee in a coffee house. And I had never been in a real German coffee house. And so I said, fine. So we went into this coffee house, and of course, because she could speak German, it opened a lot of things to us that wouldn't have been open if it had just been me, an American, by myself. And so she told them to bring the, we would call it a dessert cart. I don't know what they called it. But anyway, they wheeled this cart over there, and it was just loaded with all kinds of sweets, pieces of cake, cookies, all the kinds of things that Germans eat, torts, tarts, everything. It was overwhelming. And it was a wonderful old place. It was upstairs on the second floor in the corner of a building with just a wonderful place, quiet, peaceful. And people just went up there and did just what we were doing. They sat and had a cup of coffee and maybe had something to eat with it and maybe not. And they read the newspaper and they chatted with their friends. And it was something I have never seen the like of before or since.
A Schäferhund, P.S., is what we would call a German police dog. And they were extremely popular breed in Germany, hence, I guess, the name. And they get as big as a Mack truck and can tear your arm off. They're serious big dogs, and the kind of dogs often you see walking around with policemen. The other thing this woman introduced, I guess told Margot about her, I don't know, but I associate this fact or kind of idea with this woman, was she told us about what the Germans call and what's called a house friend. And what a house friend is or was, I don't know if they have it now or not, but it sounds a rather European idea, I think, in any case. House friend is a wealthy man who maybe is retired, but he has time in his hands and money in his pocket, and he gets connected somehow with a younger woman who's married and whose husband is out there working really hard, you know, maybe middle class or upper middle class woman. And her husband's like a banker or something. He's working and scheming away and making tons of money and never home. And he, in a sense, dates. This guy takes her out, takes her to the opera and coffee houses and those kind of things. I guess it's maybe the term cordial understanding might apply, but that's what a house friend is in Germany. One of the constant facts, I think, about that you can read in these tapes, and because it sort of impresses us, I guess, is inflation, how prices have inflated over the years. And it's an inevitable economic fact, and we see it over and over again, and I'm sure it's on our mind more than it should be. But you know, the price of cigarettes up and whatever, and everything. But in any case, I heard the ticket price for the prime seats in the new stadium that's going to be built in Seattle, and the price for the prime seats is per game $195 each. So just think of that. It's almost $400 for a couple to go watch a baseball game when they build this new stadium in the very best seats. And then I would also add to this, we drove with a taxi driver in from the train station in Denver to a just an incredibly nice little hotel in Denver near the state capitol. Just the greatest place. One of these, you know you're in a great place, they put candy on your pillow, you know, chocolate before you go to bed, and fruit baskets in the world, just a delight. Anyway, I don't want to talk about hotels, but one of the things, he was quite a Rockies fan, and the Rockies were the Denver baseball team, and they're an expansion team, and they built a brand new stadium. In fact, it hadn't been built when we were there. They were playing somewhere else. The stadium was being built, but the cab driver, he was very proud of the team and a real booster. And Denver, I think it's safe to say, is a real sports town. Where, on the other hand, I would say Seattle isn't a real sports town. I never think of, I mean, nevertheless, Seattle has a couple of professional teams, three professional teams, but I don't sense it's a sports city like some places are. But in any case, he told us a kind of fun story. He said that for every home game the Rockies sell, and I think I have the numbers right, 2,000 tickets at $2 a piece, which is extremely cheap, and it's first come, first serve, and you have to line up for these tickets. I guess they sell them in the morning for the afternoon game or whatever. But it's, and I think there's a sort of understanding that these tickets are reserved for people that are less fortunate than others, you know, people on, or old retired people on Social Security and that kind of thing. And they can buy these tickets and see a professional baseball game for $2. I think he told me that the seats were in a particular section in the stadium, so that these people all sat together. Now, Margo wasn't sure she remembered hearing that, but I don't think he was implying that the most horrible seats way up in the stadium, that they would just happen to sell a group of seats together for $2. And I think it's a really remarkable thing and a nice little story. Somewhere when I was young, about 6 or 7, I think, we lived in a place in Jersey City, and my parents owned a big, well, I guess we'd call it now, old-fashioned gas stove. It had a huge boxy oven and then four gas burners set on four tall legs. And this, I guess we moved, I don't remember what they cooked on. I think, though, maybe a wood stove that was already in the house. And in this case, the gas stove just sat absolutely, when you came in the front door, there it was. It was like this incredibly ugly, although I wouldn't have used the word when I was a kid. But I can still sort of picture this big, white, monstrous gas stove sitting there unconnected and blocking the hallway. But anyway, to get to the point of this little story is, as a little kid, I loved to, you know, unscrew things and hammer and all that. I guess all little boys do, or all little kids, I don't know. But what I did one day is carefully unscrewed the screws from, or bolts or whatever they were, from all four legs of that stove. I got underneath the stove and unscrewed all the legs. Now here I was, this little kid, with this 50-ton stove sitting over my head that could have been blown down with a feather, just sitting on four legs, maybe mostly through habit. And I guess finally on the last leg, as I went over there to show my mother, look what I did, I took all the screws out. And she almost died because that thing could have, like, ground me into the floor. I can remember at least two houses I lived in as a child, and maybe three that used a live fire to cook on. In other words, either wood common, wood stove, or coal, and or both, I guess. It's hard to imagine anybody ribbing now. You know, it's sort of, I don't know, unthinkable for most people to think of living in an apartment in a city with a wood-burning stove and cooking on wood-burning stoves. And there's quite an art to that, you know. It's not like a gas stove or whatever. How do you get your oven temperature just right and all that? It's really an art form to work on those. Not only that, somebody has to get up early in the morning to light them and get them going before you can have breakfast, usually. And I suppose they have to be kind of dangerous, too. And I would ask Margot, do you ever remember living in a house that had a...
Never.
Okay, never.
I can remember if the gas stove was down, but you know, not really the kind
of equipment. Yeah. Well, on the subject of stoves, you know, we lived in a little apartment on Zion Road in Dublin, just a great little apartment, and a strange apartment. It was the place that had three different kind of plugs in the bedroom. Three electrical plugs. You could, you know, plug A would not work in B or C, and I think maybe we talked about that. It's hard to believe anybody in sort of modern day could be so inefficient, but as to have different plug systems. But I talked to a dealer in small appliances or something, and he knew the history of it and said that Ireland at one time tried to settle on a particular kind of plug, and they argued so much, and just when the dust settled, they didn't. So I don't know what they have now. But in any case, we had a stove in this little kitchen we were in. Couldn't swing a cat in there. But this stove was an electric stove. It was really strange. It had, I don't know, two burners maybe, and a little teeny oven. The stove, the total area of the size of the stove was certainly no bigger than a small microwave. It was a really tiny stove. And what was really strange about it, it took us a while to kind of figure this out. You couldn't bake in it and cook on the surface. You had choices. If you were going to use the surface burners, the oven wouldn't work, or if you used the oven. So you know it had to, it was just run, it had a little bit more power than a flashlight battery, but somehow or other, well, we survived. While in line about this trip to Ireland, I want to say something. I just sort of hit on it when I said we survived. I think in life, it's it's difficult to lower your standard of living. It's always easy to, you know, as you make more money, you spend more money and buy fancier cars and nicer furniture, and it's easy to go up. Really hard for most people to go down. Extremely painful, in fact, if you go down far enough. And I think maybe one of the results of people retiring is that's what they have to do. They have to maybe take some nips and tucks in their standard of living. And I'm not necessarily talking about us, I'm talking as a generalization. But one of the things we did when we went to Ireland is we satisfied ourselves that we were capable of adapting and flourishing, if you will, and persevering in the face of things that a lot of people would find extremely uncomfortable. And to hear, you know, right now out here and in Canada too, in the East Coast, there's great ice storms and power lines are out and people don't have electricity and all that business. And to hear a few people interviewed on the telly, they just feel really put upon that they have to somehow survive without electricity or whatever. It's almost embarrassing to hear them, how they lack, I think, a certain amount of toughness. And what we did is we went to Dublin, we lowered our standard of living as far as the like the stove as an example, and heating the living room with a coal fire and the like. And we enjoyed ourselves and we persevered and we showed that we're adaptable and tough. On the subject of adapting and being tough and lowering your standard of living, Dublin can get bitter cold in the winter. They have snows and it can get positively frigid. But in any case, we were in Dublin during a winter where Ireland ran out of coal. You couldn't buy coal. There was no coal available. Now, a little background, the Irish government, who controlled the coal source, I guess, had a coal board or whatever. They were fond of advertising, big signs, the wonders of heating with coal or cooking with coal or whatever, and they had big billboards and always showed people in evening gowns with white rugs and white furniture and just smiling all in front of their wonderful coal stove. Well, they ran out of coal. I went down to we hopped the bus and we went down to the coal board and the headquarters for this whole coal thing, and I said, gee, well, what's the coal story? And the story was there was no coal. There wasn't any. There was none around and none available, they said. National shortage of coal. Now, mind you, please note that coal is not in short supply in Europe. They use a lot of Polish coal, I guess. And Poland was ready to go 24 hours a day digging this stuff up. Here we are in Dublin in the middle of winter, no coal. Well, Mark and I just made this an adventure. And we went out and we drove all over Dublin. I finally went out to the docks. It was called Pigeon Street or something, out to where the coal boats were, and trying to buy coal. And when the dust settled in this little adventure, we had coal. We found a bag here and a half a bag there and whatever, and we didn't piss and moan. We just knew we needed some coal to heat ourselves, and we went out and got some. And you didn't have a choice about your standard of living, because we paid high rent. We lived in a really excellent neighborhood in Dublin, a first-rate neighborhood. So you'd have to be the king of the hill to have done better than we did, and yet we were living through a coal shortage. I don't know if I mentioned before, you know, it's so hard to, you know, I ramble on and Margot rambles on at night. We're not sure what we said about this and that. But talking about shortages, honest to Pete, we were in Dublin, they had a water shortage. Now, it's hard to think about that, but they actually had, Dublin had a shortage of water. Now, how can you have, I mean, it rains there all the time. I mean, like, it's like Saudi Arabia with a shortage of sand or something, but that it's true. Funny story. In 1951, I bought two ivory figurines, Japanese carved ivory figurines. They're an old man and an old woman. Oh, they're about 3 inches high, I guess, maybe not more. And they're kind of good look things. I think that's what the Japanese had them for. And the woman is dressed in a kimono, and she's kind of she's old looking, and she's holding a broom, and also holds a turtle with a beard, or a tortoise with a beard. I suppose that's the idea of longevity, and I suspect it is. The man has a fan. He holds a regular, what we call Japanese fans, I guess, and a garden rake, and he's old too, and he's dressed in a kimono. Well, we've had these since 1951, and they're always on our dresser. They're there today. Now, what made me think about these is we're packing for Kauai tonight. Margo's packing, I'm supervising, And I have a money belt, and I was sort of stuffing money in my money belt in the bedroom with her. And I happened to look up, and I saw these two ivory carvings, these two little carved figurines, these good luck figures. But anyway, I have to say, the funny story about these is this. Margot hired, had a maid, a woman came in and cleaned up, and she was just meticulous. She cleaned this and cleaned that, and she scrubbed on this and scrubbed on that. Well, one day she proudly announced to us when we came back here, she was ready to leave. She said, "Hey, I did something extra tonight." She said, "You know those two little sculptures you had on your dresser?" I said, "Oh yeah, I know that." She said, "Well, they had turned quite brown, kind of yellow brown." She said, "I just took some Bonami," and she said, "Boy, I had a dickens of a time, but they're white as snow right now." We watched a drama the other night, and it's two men are seated and talking to each other, chatting, and one man says to the other, "Do you believe in guardian angels?" And the man says, "I've never thought much about them. I mean, I don't have an opinion on guardian angels. I don't know. I don't know anything about them." So the first man says, "Well, if you were brought up Catholic, all Catholic kids believe they have guardian angels. It's just, that absolutely is a fact. They all believe they have guardian angels." So the second guy said something like, "Would you ever see this angel, or how does that work?" He said, "No, you never see them, but they're always there." He said, "And when I was a kid, a couple of times," he said, "I'd turn around real fast to see if I could catch this guardian angel, if I could see this guardian." He said, "I never did, but I tried that on several occasions." Well, the point of this story is, Mom was watching this TV set, and she said something like, she burst out sort of spontaneously, if you will. She said, "Oh, I did that. I did that. Yeah, I did that.
I did."
Children grow up, of course, with an incredible sense of moral outrage. And one of the things I had, didn't have any understanding of it, was Haile Selassie. I was trying to dig his name up, and Haile Selassie was run off by the Italians and was brutalized and made a speech at the United Nations or whatever it was at the day. I remember seeing that in the movies. And boy, I thought Haile Selassie was a great guy. He was really being brutalized, and I was ready to declare war on somebody, Italy, I guess, over Haile Selassie. Not that I knew anything about him. But anyway, this sense of moral outrage. Well, when I was a child, and I was really young, I have to tell you, I think I've discussed this, and if I haven't, I will sometime. But, you know, I just had a dickens of a time learning to read. Reading was like, I don't know what, climbing Mount Everest barefoot or something. But eventually I did learn to read, and I loved reading, and I read a lot, and I have read a lot. I mean, dangerous amounts, I think. But one of the moral outrage things I read was about Alfred Dreyfus. I remember I read a book. Now, I was just a kid. I was not even a teenager. I think, I don't know, name it, 10 or something. I remember the book, Traitor, Traitor, Alfred Dreyfus. And, of course, I don't remember anything about the book anymore, though I know the Dreyfus story pretty well, I guess. But I remember being sort of outraged about that, too. Dreyfus, of course, was a Jew, and he was a captain in the French army, and France has had a long history of anti-Jewish. They don't like Jews. I mean, what else is new? Not just then, but now. And this, and Zola, the French writer, wrote maybe the most, I guess the most famous front page editorial comment ever in a newspaper. I can't think of another one. J'accuse, in which he came to the defense of Emile Zola. Zola, of course, apparently was innocent. He was accused of being a spy and was innocent by all accounts. And in fact, they finally caught the fellow that was the spy, and he was French, and they glossed it over. And poor Alfred Dreyfus went to Devil's Island, would you believe? Well, I bring this story up because I did read about him when I was a child, really a child, and was like outraged. Oh, they can't do this to us, you know. In any case, it's 100 years ago right now that the Zola editorial and all that took place. And it's just an incredible story. And I sort of remember it as a child. It seems like a strange thing to me that a kid would do. Margo thinks I should at least add a little bit of editorial information. Zola defended Alfred Dreyfus. He just thought he was court-martialed and received an incredibly raw deal. Dreyfus himself was from Alsace-Lorraine, which is a region, a long kind of skinny hot dog-shaped area between France and Germany, and has been a bone of contention for many years. The Germans, I guess, in 1870-71, just kicked the pookie out of France and took over Alsace-Lorraine, which is this bone of contention then. And I think, to carry the story even on, I think that the Treaty of Versailles, when France lorded over the Germans after World War I, I think France regained Alsace-Lorraine. And it's been a disputed area. Well, in any case, Alfred Dreyfus had two marks against him. He was from Alsace-Lorraine, and he was a Jew. And he was accused, essentially, of being a spy and helped engineer this loss of this region to Germany. And, of course, it was just a matter of incredible prestige that they lost this. But I think a lot of it simply had to do with that he was a Jew. I think he was an easy target. And Zola, who was really, his really literary career was about finished. He came to Alfred Dreyfus's defense and tried to say that I guess essentially I accuse you of railroading this guy into prison. And he really, yeah, he did hard time in Devil's Island. Now, that was not a fun city in those days to go to Devil's Island. So anyway, for you youngsters listening, go read about it. It's a great story. 3 weeks later, P.S., because we went to Hawaii, which I'll maybe talk a little bit about, but I read within the last couple of weeks or so that a major French newspaper, and you know, we can think of something, Le Monde is one or whatever, and I forget which one it was, but a major French paper has publicly apologized 100 years later, plus, please note, for their anti-Semitic editorials that they ran during the trial and all that business. It took 100 years. Margo and I are just back from a trip to Kauai. We spent 3 months there.
3 weeks.
I'm sorry. I started to say 3 years. I want to say, I want to go there 3 years, 3 months. No, but let's start over. We were there 3 weeks, and it was wonderful. We had planned this, and we decided to go for 2 weeks, and then Cindy and Kathy to our great delight and absolute surprise, totally out of the blue, that Christmas gave us a third week there, which we really appreciated. And it was wonderful. It was the second time we went to Kauai, of course. Everyone, many people know listening to the tape, this is true. First time we took Ethan and Emma. And we went to the same place, Leinani, which we really, really liked, and stayed within in an apartment right next to the other one we had stayed in on the third floor, and we just loved it there. I think Kauai is paradise. I can't tell you the weather, the air, the sun, the sky, the water, the sand, everything is perfect. And maybe we'll talk a little bit about that on the tape. But in any case, when the four of us went to Kauai, the last night, the night before we left to go hop on back on the plane, we went down to a very holy place, actually a temple area built by the ancient Hawaiians. And it's right on the grounds of this, on the water's edge, in the ocean, if you will, of this place we stayed at. And these places weren't really like buildings, they were enclosures, and they built, I think, some temporary structures in them. I suppose a bamboo pole and a thatched roof or some tapa walls and that kind of thing. But the walls around them, of course, were built with basalt and volcanic rock and what have you, and they're there forever, relatively. So the night before we left Kauai, we went down to Forest Town to this really sacred enclosure, if you will. A beautiful spot, green in the water, crashing in just right over the flowers and all that, just really great. We kind of all bowed, held hands, and vowed that we maybe never would return, the four of us together. That, I suppose that would be, we wouldn't, but if any of us returned, we would to Kauai, this one island, this beautiful, the garden island, because of its so